This tape was recorded live at the 1983 Sunstone Symposium held in Salt Lake City. The Spectrum of Religious Beliefs and Behaviors, presented by Jan Stout. Responding to the paper is Gordon Madsen. Let's go now to the session in progress.
We'd like to welcome you to this session of the Sunstone Symposium. I have been asked to remind you that admission to the sessions is by a prepaid registration tag that you, most of you, are wearing, and if you don't have one of these, you can obtain them at the Bonneville lobby. There are banquet tickets still available until noon today, and you can also obtain these at the registration desk. I'm really pleased to be able to introduce to you Dr. Jan Stout today, and I hope you'll forgive my informality, because whenever I say Dr. Stout, I always think of his brother, and Jan has just always been Jan to me. But he is married and has four very clever daughters and a charming wife. He graduated from the University of Utah Medical School, had a residency at Stanford Medical Center in psychiatry. He's a board-certified psychiatrist, a fellow of the American Psychiatry Association, past president of the Utah Psychiatric Association, clinical assistant professor of psychiatry at the University of Utah Medical Center, and in private practice. And I might add that he has a large practice, many Mormon people in all shapes and sizes and shades of belief. One of the things that has always impressed me about Jan is, first of all, his keen mind and probably his sincere search and interest in truth, and then a special talent that he has is an ability to, I'm trying to think of the word, stimulate one to reevaluate his opinions and his biases. And this he's done to me often, and I'm sure unknowingly. After Jan, we will hear the response from Gordon Madsen, another friend who is an attorney in town, another fine mind which is packed full of information, unknown facts about Mormons, about the people, the history, the doctrine. You'll find him interesting. So I will turn the time over to them.
Thank you very much, Pam. I appreciated those words. And I've really appreciated all of the things that have been said in these two sessions prior to this. I felt like they helped me a lot in just thinking through some of the things I'm going to be saying today. I was particularly interested in Marvin Ridding's comment about his new church that he's formed, that he referred to as the Cosmic Uncertainty Church. Was that right? I have to claim that we've done this before. We're ahead of him already. A colleague of mine and myself have formed a new church called the BBC, the Big Bang Church. And we had a creation myth that a lot of people would find very interesting. Well, enough of that. To the outside world, Mormons are often viewed as a cohesive group of people who share a common world view, a fixed set of beliefs, and adhere strongly to similar values and religious commitments. The relatively brief historical record of the Latter-day Saints adds to this perception. Mormons survived persecution, intolerance, and hatred largely because of their faith, their solidarity, and obedience to strong and forceful leadership. Despite this appearance of conformity and unity, there exists a wide spectrum of beliefs and behaviors in the Mormon community. This should come as no surprise to any thoughtful observer, for few human institutions are composed of people who act and think in identical ways. It would seem that excessive conformity and rigidity would doom the vitality and the growth of a religious body. And conversely, the vigorous synthesis of a variety of individual beliefs and customs should contribute to a religion's survivability. Diversity and interpersonal tension has characterized the Mormon experience, The religion has accommodated, at least for a time, such people as Sidney Rigdon, John C. Bennett, and Porter Rockwell. These were individuals woven into the same religious and social fabric as were Brigham Young, Eliza Snow, and Heber C. Kimball. In more contemporary times, we see a dazzling variety of persons who identify themselves as Mormons. Bruce R. McConkie to Sterling McMurrin, Donny Osmond to J.D. Williams, and Hugh Nibley to Leonard Arrington. The list could go on and on. I'm sure many of you have your own people you'd like to mention. Richard Paul, in his now classic dialogue article, identified two distinct types of aptly named the Iron Rods and the Liahonas. These two groups approach their religious commitment from essentially opposite directions, one being based on obedience to revealed truth, conformity, and the avoidance of provocative questions. The other, pursuing active questioning, mistrust of dogma, and personal direction. They are polarized in their approach to religion, yet they share and they value the significance of Mormonism in their spiritual lives. I just noticed 2 days ago that the Dialogue summer issue of 1983 came out with an article by Richard Pohl, 15-year retrospect, looking at his article on Liahonas and Iron Rods, and I would commend it to all of you. The plight of Mormon intellectuals has been reviewed by many writers in Dialogue and Sunstone, and certainly we've heard them here in this conference. These Latter-day Saints are often portrayed as living in great conflict, feeling lonely and disenfranchised. They are constantly struggling to reconcile their religious teachings with the historical, scientific, and literary insights of the academic world. More recently, at a Sunstone Theological Symposium, 1982, Jeff Burton unearthed the closet doubter. We've had reference to that again this year. Defined as an active Latter-day Saint who has secretly rejected basic church tenets, this type of individual finds himself in an uneasy state of tension, subtle dishonesty, and personal conflict. He formulates a variety of adaptive compromises to remain in the rewarding and the secure world of Mormondom. Being a Latter-day Saint closet doubter can be a highly ambivalent enterprise, for powerful love-hate feelings arise in the push-pull of conformity, acceptance, and the resolution of guilt feelings. As we examine religious beliefs in the Mormon community, we must attempt to identify what it means to be religious. It is generally accepted that the religious experience involves questions about ultimate meaning and concern, that is, the intellectual, transcendent feeling states, the affective or the emotional, and the practice of rituals and the search for powerful symbols, the practical and the participatory. Walter Kaufman, one of my favorite authors, in grappling with this definition has stated, quotes, "In religion, practice, feeling, and belief are intertwined, and every definition that would see the essence of religion in just one of these three facets is too partial," close quotes. Successful religions always provide integration of these three dimensions of involvement. There is a body of facts and truths and assertions which must nourish the theologians and the philosophers among us. Feelings of ecstasy, wonderment, and awe supply the mystical and the transcendent needs. Ritualistic practices provide continuity, tradition, and solemnity for binding the intellect and the emotions in a workable format. People obviously vary in the relative importance of these three factors in their lives, but all must be present to make for a widely accepted religion. Mormonism does provide a rich blend and powerful blend of these essential religious ingredients. I contend that man is, of necessity, a religious creature. We all share the basic problems of existence, which cannot forever be shielded from scrutiny. The awakening of self-awareness made this inevitable. This self-awareness arose from our human condition, whether we see it in scientific, biological, evolutionary, and cultural terms, or in the biblical expulsion account of Adam and Eve, which has been chronicled in Genesis. Regardless of how we see this collectively, we were left to struggle with questions of evil, death, ultimacy, and purpose. These primordial queries stirred the souls of our ancient ancestors, giving rise to rituals, supernatural dreams, and magical thinking. Ken Wilber, in his scholarly achievement, Up From Eden, traces man's great chain in being from the pre-personal subconscious of primitive man to the personal self-consciousness of today's man, then onward to the enlightened transpersonal superconsciousness. Man's groping for religious meaning has evolved. Sigmund Freud, in his epic work, The Future of an Illusion, and Eric Fromm in Psychoanalysis and Religion, have given us valuable insights about this process as well. The point to be emphasized remains: we are religious creatures. We share common concerns, wishes, and hopes. M. Scott Peck, who was a guest of Sunstone a year ago, has observed, since everyone has some understanding, some worldview, no matter how limited or primitive or inaccurate, everyone has a religion. I might add, I just had a little moment of grace occur yesterday. I went back to my office just on the hunch that I might have a letter in the mail, and there was a letter from Scott Peck wishing us well at the Sunstone Symposium and sending his greetings. His book, The People of the Lie, The Hope for Healing Human Evil, is going to be published this fall, and it's had some very interesting reviews, and I think something we'll all look forward to. As I said, everyone has a religion. I would add, we only stop being religious when we cease to question, to ponder, and to struggle with what it means to be human. Once we accept this equality of spiritual questioning, we can begin to understand and explore the differences that seem to separate us. Cultural Mormons, Jack Mormons, intellectuals, fundamentalists, closet doubters, active temple goers, Leah Honers, iron rods, all need to recognize their shared human heritage. This heritage comes not only from our Mormon ancestors, but from the human evolutionary experience. Fundamentally, we Homo sapiens are far more alike than we are different. Yet our dogmatic beliefs and our behaviors keep us mistrustful of one another. A central question arises: how do Mormons arrive at the point where their beliefs acquire form and definition? Is it only the function of complex psychological processes, cultural pressures, dogmatic teachings? Do God, the Holy Ghost, and Jesus Christ intervene to build testimonies for the faithful, the prayerful, and the humble among us? Are the intellectuals always doomed to read by the lamp of their own conceit? Do we want our beliefs to reduce uncertainty and tension, or to increase awareness, contingent knowledge, and existential anxiety? The formation of beliefs and religious practices, of course, is a highly complex and multi-determined phenomenon, and it's beyond the scope of this paper to explore the factors involved in this process. I would like instead to examine Mormons' diverse attitudes and orientations from a somewhat limited conceptual approach. While these factors can be considered universal for all humans, I will attempt to focus on their impact for the Latter-day Saint. We now need to begin with the problem of anxiety. The experience of anxiety can be divided into three basic forms, each giving rise to different developmental tasks in our lives. Psychiatrists have described these types as separation anxiety, castration anxiety, and existential anxiety. Each seems to play a significant role in the stages of our psychic growth. Fundamentally, each is inextricably interwoven into the shroud of our ultimate human dilemma. And that dilemma is coping with death and the fear of our personal extinction. I didn't add that last sentence in my first draft, so it wouldn't be in yours, Gordon, but I had to add that last sentence because I felt behind all of these anxieties is the real reason for our ultimate anxiety, and that is dealing with death. And that's the reason that our religions have sprung up in all nations and all cultures and all people. We have to deal with the fact that we are finite creatures, and we have to find meaning to that finiteness and try to make that leap beyond. Separation anxiety can be identified as the most primal of our tension-producing states. The infant's first encounter with this affect occurs when mother is no longer there at his beck and call. He feels alone, vulnerable, and abandoned. The security of the womb has been lost, and new and frightening perceptions are encountered. The separation of the bond with mother must be endured repeatedly and eventually numbed through denial and repression. Yet this original experience serves as a prototype for the anxiety state. It can be replayed countless times, and we must struggle to acquire defenses and solutions to its impact. Castration anxiety does not necessarily mean specific anatomical dismemberment, nor is it sex-linked and exists only for men. This is rather convoluted in trying to explain this from Freudian theory, but we're going to use it in a more generalized sense. It is the type of anxiety that accompanies the fear of punishment and retribution of any kind. We become aware of our lack of power and our need to seek support. We may have transgressed against a perceived and powerful authority figure and desperately want to escape the inevitable wrath of his judgment. I might add, this is beginning in the young child's life as he's dealing with castration anxiety, just as with separation anxiety. A solution to our predicament can be joining a group for collective protection. Suddenly, fear and powerlessness can be transformed into strength and security. Existential anxiety arises when we are forced to confront the terror and the uncertainty of a universe that seems awesome and overwhelming. We look beyond the safety of our family and predictable events to a world that is full of risks, dangers, and unknowns. There is no ready refuge from this awareness and dread. Traditional reassurances and answers will not fill the void. In experiencing existential anxiety, we have looked beyond into new and challenging frontiers. I liked what Carlyle had to say this morning in our first discussion, where he talked about confronting and living with the agony and the ecstasy and finding therein the tragic sense of life. I think that's part of what we have to confront when we deal with existential anxiety, to discover the tragic sense of life. We are now ready to examine the interplay of anxiety with the development of a religious orientation. The choices, and I put that in quotes, are certainly not conscious and are not influenced by are influenced by factors other than anxiety resolution. Role models, identification, the pressure to conform, and other learning devices all will contribute to the establishment of a theological position. There's been provocative new research in the area of sociobiology, which suggests that genetics may even have a role in the development of our religious behavior. Studies of monozygotic twins reared apart imply that even our religious activities may be influenced by powerful biological forces. Yet I believe that the force of anxiety remains a central process or central factor in this process. Our religious beliefs are profoundly influenced by specific individuals who will carry the word. Visionary prophets have the ability to touch the lives of countless followers and provide a beacon on which to focus the religious meaning of their experience. Abraham Maslow has observed, quotes, "The very beginning, the intrinsic core, the essence, the universal nucleus of every high known religion has been the private, lonely, and personal illumination, revelation, or ecstasy of some acutely sensitive prophet." While it may be hard to argue that Joseph Smith was a lonely prophet, he certainly carried the charismatic powers and the spiritual message that gave birth to a vital new religion. I do not wish to suggest that conversion experiences were and are solely motivated by attempts to limit the anxiety states that I have discussed. However, the need to belong, the escape from fiends of powerlessness, and the fresh infusion of meaning into the lives of converts significantly augmented the wish to be Mormon. The core religious experience is perhaps beyond the ultimate understanding of any psychological theory. I will now discuss four groups of Mormons who seem to have arrived at the religious positions from the complex interplay of anxiety, social forces, and life experience. The first are called compliant dependent. The second, social organizational. The third, skeptic individual. And the fourth, transcendent integrated. These designations are, of course, not limited to Latter-day Saints, but exist in all major religions. And I'm indebted to M. Scott Peck for a general outline of some of these positions or types, which I have modified to some extent to fit the Mormon experience. One is also reminded of the contributions made by Kohlberg in his Stages of Moral Development. These stages of spiritual development should not be viewed as fixed or stationary. Some individuals may be content to spend most of their lives in one such position, while others will move through all of the stages in a continuum of growth. Under times of disillusionment or great emotional stress, there may be regressions to a place where safety and comfort are enhanced. While the implication exists that one stage is higher and therefore better than the other, we should acknowledge that people's needs do vary and differ widely. Basic personality styles may favor the development of a specific religious orientation, just as we heard in Marvin Ridding's response to the paper of last hour, quoting some of Jung's personality types. These are ways in which religious orientation can be fostered. Some individuals are naturally more passive and non-inquisitive. Others are more exploratory and curious. Still others will hunger for absolute certainty, while their counterparts thrive on seeking out mystery. However, I believe that the ultimate position one takes will determine to a great extent the way in which he will view God, his place in the universe, and will contribute to his expectations for rewards, judgment, and exaltation. We may readily see these traits in others, but I contend they exist to some extent in all of us. For we all have experienced the same anxieties and struggled with a difficult resolution process. It is also possible for us to experience these conflicts simultaneously. This paper intends to examine the role that these three types of anxiety play in the genesis of four religious subgroups. I feel that each of these groups has something important to contribute to the spiritual and the religious life of the Mormon community. For that matter, they contribute to our own individual religious life. Let's begin with the compliant dependent, which I'll refer to as CDs. Compliant dependent traits can arise in response to separation anxiety. These people retain the basic orientation of childhood. There's a strong need to please, to submit, and to obey, to avoid the dreaded fear of abandonment. CDs are adept at scanning the horizon for cues that keep them safely in the normative center. Belief can easily become subservient to personal comfort. Monson has referred to people he calls habit doers and God gamblers. They live with their childhood habits, never bothering to ask significant questions, or they argue that God exists and religious activity is important, feeling they have everything to gain and nothing to lose by believing, and conversely, nothing to gain and everything to lose by disbelief. These types could easily fit into the CD category, preferring not to risk being cut off from warm nurturing. There's a strong desire for unconditional love, and a great emphasis is placed on people-pleasing. The syndrome described as Mother of Zion seems to largely evolve from compliant-dependent behavior. Many can also recall a cozying, satisfying memory of a star placed on the forehead in junior Sunday school, or the smile of approval from a pleased parent at the end of a 2.5-minute talk. Strong reinforcement stuff, isn't it? Religious symbols and messages that promise us the chance of overcoming separation are very highly prized. Ernest Becker noted in his monumental work, The Denial of Death, quotes, "We obey authority figures all of our lives, as Freud showed, because of the anxiety of separation. Every time we try to do something other than what they wanted, we awaken the anxiety connected with them and their possible loss. To lose their powers and approval is thus to lose our very lives." Close quotes. The strength of this drive for symbiotic comfort is rooted in our infancy, and it never completely leaves us. For CDs, it remains the ultimate motivator for their religious life. A note of caution is needed here. We should not take separation anxiety too lightly or view it simply as childlike and infantile. It is not reserved for compliant, dependent people alone. The feeling of intimacy, ecstasy, and unity with God may be essential to the transcendent religious experience described by Harris in his book, I'm Okay, You're Okay. If you haven't read the chapter on religion in the Harris book, go back and read it. It's by far the best chapter in the whole book. It's just full of goodies. Certainly, overcoming separation is the central message of the atonement. However, to remain childlike and dependent is to deny the personal responsibility we all share in attaining an integrated religious life. Kierkegaard is warned, to venture causes anxiety, but not to venture is to lose oneself. Now, the social organization, the SOs, SO people value the group above all else. These Mormons find form and therefore security in the structure of the church. They gravitate towards authority, and they often like positions of power themselves. They can be rigid, legalistic, and obsessive-compulsive. They fear losing control and dealing with powerful emotions. They are Maslow's non-peakers and religious bureaucrats. For SOs, the core anxiety revolves around punishment, the loss of power and impotence. This castration anxiety is a product and an invention of the child, but can consume the psychic life of adults as well. Obedience to strong, authoritarian religious bodies can, to a large extent, help relieve this fear. Rituals and order become important, and the attention to detail and proficiency in scriptural recall is highly coveted by these Mormons. The Iron Rod saint, as described by Paul, is perfectly at home in this category. These people play a very important role in the organizational structure of the church, however, for through their hard work, their loyalty, their obedience, they often rise to levels of considerable authority themselves. Yet it's sometimes easier for them to follow the letter rather than the spirit of the law. As in the compliant dependent, the social organizational type is rooted in basic childhood anxieties. For both, as Fromm has observed, quotes, the main virtue is obedience, and its cardinal sin is disobedience. Just as the deity is conceived as omnipotent or omniscient, man is conceived, often unconsciously, as being powerless and insignificant. Only as he can gain grace or help from the deity by complete surrender can he find and feel strength. The SO's primary aim is to receive protection and rewards from God in return for submission and obedience. There is often great concern with the coming of the last days and ultimate judgment. Love is considered conditional, and there is a strong patriarchal orientation wherein God is perceived as a loving father who rewards his children only when they have been dutiful, obedient, and faithful to the end. Now we're ready to move on to the skeptic individual, the SI. The SI has learned to deal with existential anxiety, or at least to confront it. The formulation that seemed to work earlier in childhood in answering religious questions of life begins to falter. As one surveys the complexities of life and numerous uncertainties, doubts can arise. Does God really intervene and answer prayers regularly, if at all? Why was I born at this time and in such a place of such favorable circumstances? And what about God's other children who live in abject poverty and suffer miserable life situations, the kind of tragic life that Carla Hunsaker referred to? These questions cannot easily be answered nor set to rest by the skeptic individual person. They continue to gnaw on his conscience and generate even further questioning. As one is exposed to more secular education, speculation inevitably will expand. There's a growing sense of individual responsibility rather than a reliance on the church to answer and resolve questions of doubt. For some, this is a time of rebelling against authority or against one's own compliant dependent wishes. Skepticism may appear in early adolescence. It may be brief, or it may last a lifetime. Some Mormons successfully compartmentalize their religious beliefs and teachings from secular curiosity and growth. They can develop powerful intellectual insights and scientific knowledge which doesn't threaten nor contaminate their theological faith. They stay safely in stage one or two previously described, and their intellectual growth doesn't seriously challenge their religious structure. Personal tragedies can catapult us into the SI stance. Some Mormons find themselves bewildered, disillusioned, and betrayed by their previous religious orientation. This may lead to falling away into inactivity and cynicism. One may even angrily assert that God doesn't exist and never did, and reject all forms of active religious life. Or there may be quiet abandonment of a cherished spiritual commitment. Some SIs will evolve into the closet doubter, described by Burton. They do not want to abandon their religious ties, but they covertly struggle with questions and doubts. Others search for new ways to interpret the gospel and to deal with life's mysteries. Skeptic individualistic people often want to reject compliant, dependent, and social organizational Mormons. and they resent such traits in themselves. And yet they are there in all of us, as I've said. There can be an exhilarating sense of freedom in learning to live with doubt, uncertainty, and questions. Existential anxiety can encourage growth, and it can inspire courage and daring to explore new horizons. Yet the danger is always present of slipping in denialism, cynicism, and meaninglessness. For these reasons, SI Mormons often envy the certainty and the security enjoyed by unquestioning church members. They look back nostalgically to a time of life when things seemed much more predictable and secure. Can many of you identify with that? I hope so. The transcendent integrated person, the TI. These are probably few among us. While many may have had brief tastes of this position in life, it is an elusive stage and very difficult to maintain. The first three stages that I have described are largely egoic in nature. By egoic, I mean the individual's self-awareness and self-consciousness seems to play a primary role. For there's great concern with personal salvation, with the preservation of power, with the awareness of one's own intellectual life. The transcendent integrated person has been able to move beyond these egoic concerns, which dominate most of our lives. Yet this position is available to all of us through those moments of spiritual enlightenment that Maslow has described as peak experiences. We become aware of feelings of ecstasy, of wholeness, and we comprehend the unity of all things. Our concern for our fellow men transcends our narrow self-interests. At this level, the integrated aspects of our personality become crucial. Lowell Bunyan, one of my favorite authors, in his small and beautiful book, The Things That Matter Most, discusses the importance of integrity. He states, quotes, "There are two moral virtues which, I believe, encompass all others, integrity and love. If we would cultivate these two with an increasing understanding of their meaning, we would fulfill our moral nature and find deep joy and great satisfaction." Close quotes. In this stage, we seek the integration of all moral values which give deeper meaning to life. Existential anxiety is quieted, and we seem to come to terms with our being. I just noticed this in this week's Reader's Digest, which I'm sure you all have someplace in your house. There's a beautiful little article by Artis Whitman, which she entitles Those Magic Moments at the Core of Life. And she's talking eloquently about the transcendent experience and those times which give our lives that depth and meaning and help us discover that wholeness. Many Mormons will identify church leaders in and out of the church hierarchy, general authorities who seem to personify the transcendent integrated person for them. These people inspire and touch our lives in deep and significant ways. They seem to have found a resolution to all of the stages that I've described thus far. They recognize these traits in themselves and therefore can love and accept a broad spectrum of Mormons who are struggling with their own spiritual lives. I think for me, as I look back from my childhood, I'm not sure if I've embellished it, but for me it was David O. McKay. I still get all kinds of feelings even when I say his name, and I remember as a young boy shaking his hand in our ward, which is a very moving experience for me. And I give him this position, at least in my life. Now we're ready to move on to some conclusions. As religious beings, we humans are embarked on a spiritual pilgrimage to discover meaning and purpose to our existence. This journey has sifted out a kaleidoscope of religious movements which seek to give answers and directions to our theological quest. To be truly universal, a religion must provide a fertile environment for all the stages of spiritual growth and experience. Mormonism incorporates a vast array of theological doctrines, strong traditions, and opportunities for active participation. Levels of consciousness and concern vary significantly among Mormons, whether converts or church-born. The spectrum spreads from those with what appear to be simplistic, literal, and mind-numbing views to those imbued with deep, humanistic, transpersonal, and spiritual commitments. And between these polarities, we see a great variety of individual belief and behavior. I have suggested that coping with three fundamental types of anxiety is a central factor in the development of four religious groupings, which can be identified in the Mormon community. The compliant dependent and the social organizational Latter-day Saint have discovered a solution to their respective anxiety problems. Through orthodoxy, these Mormons view their beliefs and testimonies as a reward from God for obedience, steadfastness, and humility. They have, at least temporarily, found a degree of certitude in a complex and chaotic world, which gives meaning, clarity, and direction to their lives. Their faith and behavior coincide with the official word from leaders, scriptures, and their respected peers, and they feel whole and justified. The more liberal, skeptic individual Mormon must be willing to live with tensions, ambiguity, and uncertainty. His position can easily disintegrate into a worldview of cynicism, nihilism, and existential anguish. He often sees a return to the first two positions as regression, a spiritual cop-out, as it were. The SI stage can be a place for new discovery and religious growth, however, a platform for exploring the mysteries and expanding awareness can be developed, a very exciting place for the adventuring and the curious Mormon. I have concluded that there is and there should be ample room in the Mormon Church for all the stages I have described. This diversity makes for a vigorous religious community. The first three stages can partially fulfill our basic needs and wishes. They are all focused on the question, however, what's in it for me? What's in it for me? Ultimate spiritual fulfillment beckons us to move toward the transcendent integrated position. Short of this, we are locked into our egoic interests, and therefore we remain in a perpetual state of spiritual separation. The aim of the TI religious experience is to discover that wholeness and thus to find oneself whole as well. Albert Einstein called it the removal of the optical delusion that we are separate individuals set off from the whole. As spiritual beings, we all have access to this awareness and can overcome prejudice, mistrust, and self-righteousness. Through understanding, empathy, and genuine humility about our common human condition, we can learn unity with all of our fellow travelers on this fragile planet. Ken Wilber has eloquently written, quotes, "We can set history in a context that is at once scientific and spiritual, immanent and transcendent, empirical and meaningful. For this view tells us that history is indeed going somewhere. It is going not towards a final judgment, but toward that ultimate wholeness." Close quotes. Perhaps the most succinct call to self-transcendence is found in St. Matthew 10:39. "He that findeth his life shall lose it, and he that loseth his life for my sake shall find it." This, then, is the essence of overcoming meaninglessness and emptiness of egoic pursuits. It is a unifying message, not only for Mormons, but for all people seeking a life of spiritual growth. Thank you.
I appreciate the chance to participate in this seminar, and I don't know why I was picked as the respondent for Jan's paper, and Jan and I do go back some years together with his brother as well, and his mother and the other family. But I suppose, can't you hear me? Sorry about that. You haven't missed a thing. I suppose the reason that I was picked to be the respondent is that I don't know a thing about psychiatry, and that probably insulates Jan in the best possible position to start. The other reason, I suppose, is that, just as Marlene Owens indicated yesterday, Martha Ball is a very difficult person to say no to. The one very minor nit that I want to pick to start with relates to the statement in which, after quoting Maslow, Jan says, "While it may be hard to argue that Joseph Smith was a lonely prophet to fit Maslow's definition, I think that the reverse is true. I think he could be very easily argued to have been a lonely prophet within that classic mold. As witness his statement to his mother Well, I suppose we should begin by a quote that I heard from a young woman in a single ward with which I was involved for a couple of years, in which she just simply said in a sacrament meeting, "Loneliness is all the hell one needs in this life." Joseph told his mother, after the three witnesses had seen the plates, "At last, I am not alone. At last, there are others that are going to have to testify to the existence of these plates." As he repeatedly said, particularly in the Nauvoo period, words to the effect, as the one more famous sermon, "If I were to tell you all that I know, you would fly apart like glass. I have been nurturing you carefully, slowly, and trying to share with you what I've known for some time, but if I give it to you any faster, you'll explode on me." As witness the little letter in that marvelous phonetic spelling of Heber C. Kimball to Parley P. Pratt in the Nauvoo period, Brother Joseph feels as well as I have seen him, ever seen him. One reason is he has got a small company that he feels safe in their presence, in their hands, and that he can open his bosom to and feel himself safe. "I wish you were here so as to feel and hear for yourself. We have received some precious things through the prophet on the priesthood that would cause your soul to rejoice." I think he was indeed, in the very real sense that most prophets or seers or great thinkers are, lonely. I think that the lonely of excellence is a very peculiar kind of loneliness. So, and I don't mean to overemphasize it, that's a very minor nit to pick. Otherwise, I think Jan's paper certainly accomplishes exactly what it sets out to do, to make a very coherent and clear definition as to what we are. And it's one of the natural, I think, cop-outs of reviewers to then say, "But I wish he would have done this. I wish he had done that in addition." Sure, we can wish, but we didn't set the parameters of his paper. He did. And I don't know that it's a fair criticism to say, "Why didn't you also? Why didn't we add? Why didn't you go on that tangent?" Now, having said that, can I tell you what I wish he had done? What I wish he had done was tell us, he admits at the outset, that these same traits of the CDs, SOs, SIs, and TIs exist in all of us. I wish he had said how the transition is made, and indeed, obviously making it apparent that the final one, the TI, is the stage that we ought to seek for and to progress toward. I wish you'd given us more of the how-to, and that's, I suppose, a byproduct of this society, of all of the books, and I suppose the repeated articles in the Ensign as to how to be the best home teacher and how to be the, you know, etc. I wish, therefore, there had been something more than quoting Lowell Bunyan's work about the importance of integrity and love, for example, and his concluding quote from the scripture about losing one's life in the Savior's service. I see some integrity and love in each of those four classifications, obviously, of a different variety, perhaps, or intensity. I wonder how one works toward these peak experiences and then maintains them in a more meaningful, persistent, continuous way. And I wish he would also, having quoted that marvelous definition from Kaufman that talks about the three elements of religion, feeling, intellect, and ritual, would have spent some time explaining how the ritual aspect of our church gives meaning to and support for these various classifications. Seems to me, and that's the one I should like to briefly zero in on, it seems to me that we, because, and I'm not certain why, I can see some peripheral reasons perhaps, the principal ritual in this church is the temple ceremony. And we leave it unspoken, unrelated to. Largely because parts of it we are committed to keep private. To be safe, we therefore say nothing except to our children, "Go there and get married." Right? And don't ask me anything about it. Just go. Right. The other, perhaps, reason that we do not put our particular ritual into context with our belief and our behavior is that we think of temple work, because of the church's great emphasis on genealogical research, that we're going there to waste some time to do a favor for a dead friend. And or relative, as the case may be, and in effect sleep through it. And I had a discussion with a general authority once who was telling me about some cosmetic changes in the ceremony and asked me out of the blue what I would do to change the ceremony, and I was taken completely off guard, as if I could make any suggestion that would be of any import to begin with. But then I said, well, I hope you don't get rid of the element of humor that I find there. And he said, humor? And I said, yes, there's one place particularly where the brethren are asked to close their eyes as if they were asleep. And I said, half of them aren't pretending at all. You know. I was comforted by the Mike Quinn biography of J. Reuben Clark, who observed the same phenomena himself and was heard to say, it's a little like the dead doing work for the dead. But what I should like to suggest, if I may quickly and briefly, that our ritual can be and ought to be far more meaningful to us here and now in terms of our stage of religious commitment and the kind of life we are. And if I can just give you two or three quotes and summarize, we'll turn it over to questions. From Heber C. Kimball, in all these ordinances of the gospel, we imitate Christ. Even in the endowment, there is not a solitary thing but what is an imitation of the Son or the Father in some way or other. And all this is done to keep us in remembrance of Him. Have you ever gone to the temple with that concept in mind as you listened? I have another good friend who said, I wish the temple ceremony could be rewritten to make Christ more the focal point. And I wondered to myself, what ceremony was he listening to? And I'm listening to that we should be that diametrically opposed. I find him central through the whole process, from his creative role at the beginning to my being ultimately accountable to him as I pass into the celestial room. I can't imagine anything more written to focus on the Savior and our relationship to him, if we but open our ears. In the Gospel of Philip, a pseudepigraphal writing that was part of the Nag Hammadi Library discovered in Egypt in 1945, come these, I think, rather pregnant words. The Lord did everything by ordinance, there being five steps: baptism, anointing, Eucharist, or as we would say, sacrament, ransom, or sacrifice, and bridal chamber. One must receive a new name with the anointing of ransom, becoming no longer a Christian, but a Christ. From Brigham Young, defining the endowment, let me give you the definition in brief. Your endowment is to receive all those ordinances of the house of the Lord which are necessary for you after you have departed this life, to enable you to walk back to the presence of the Father, passing the angels who stand as sentinels, being enabled to give them the key words, the signs and tokens pertaining to the holy priesthood, and gain your eternal exaltation in spite of earth and hell. And from 2 Nephi chapter 9, verse 41, speaking of those sentinels, Nephi characterizes it as the straight gate through which all must pass, and then continues, "And the keeper of the gate is the Holy One of Israel, and he employeth no servant there. And there is none other way, save it be at by the gate, for he cannot be deceived, for the Lord God is his name." I submit that if we were to take the time to concentrate on this, our ritual, rather than think of it, as I say, as some vicarious act for some deceased person, and integrate the concepts that are there being taught, and I admit that, of course, there is a good deal of the human element in human nature in dealing with human portrayers, whether they be live or whether they be on film, is distracting. And I find myself closing my eyes to concentrate more on listening, although I am therefore presumed one of those that are not pretending. Nonetheless, it seems to me that with that experience, that ritual that, as Jan points out, gives continuity and meaning to our belief and our behavior, that we have entirely exclusively to ourselves, almost independent of any institutional organization, although it takes one to build the facility and all of that, and man it and the rest. Nonetheless, that can be a totally personal and private opportunity on a recurring, entirely within our own control, a constant, continuing, recurring, ritualistic investment of meaning that I think should be summated toward arriving at the TI level, which Dr. Stout points out is probably the only successful, satisfying area of behavior or commitment in this kingdom. Thank you.